master jury list and from the qualification questionnaires, what the racial demographics are. You really don't know until the people show up at the courthouse on the day of trial in response to the summons. And so using the geography and the demographics of the different zip codes in Champaign County really is a proxy to try and model what the demographic composition looks like at every stage of the jury process and how it might be shifting. We use this as a diagnostic tool to see if there is a particular stage in the jury process that may be contributing to a skewing, to a dramatic change in terms of the demographics over time, as well as also just looking at the geographic representation, which is always a good thing to look at as well. You don't want to have a particular locality that just kind of, you know, drops off at some point for some reason. Usually that refers to some type of automation problem. And we've seen that in a couple of courts where, you know, it's nothing intentional, but there's a software glitch, a bug that's in the computer program that just is not working properly. And so it's a good diagnostic tool. So that's the basic methods that I use. Were there any questions about the methods before I go on with the specific findings?
We have some people coming in. We got a lot of rain here, so folks
okay.
Kind of making their way in.
You want to talk to the microphone, please? We're being recorded through the microphone system. So
we didn't need that one to hear.
So I'm just kind of letting everybody get situated over here.
Oh, no trouble. Yeah,
you can
talk.
So for the individuals who just came in, Ms. Hannaford is just kind of giving us a summary of the process that she used, and she was wondering if there were any questions about the process that she used at this point. I don't think, it doesn't look like anyone has any real questions about the process at this point. Some may come up here in a little while.
Okay.
So if you'd like to go ahead and define it.
Well, let me just, you know, I will cut to the chase. The data that I was working from was just distributed, I believe it was during the month of April, in the Champaign County jury pool. And as I said, the response rate was very good. And so what I did was look at those both in terms of, you know, mainly in terms of race and ethnicity, and compared that to U.S. Census Bureau data, both for the 2000 decennial census, as well as the Census Bureau does an annual survey now. It's a survey, which means it's a sample. They're sending questionnaires to approximately six, one out of every six households nationally. And so it's called the American Community Survey. And so the statistics that I was working with was basically a three-year average from 2005 and 2007. Just because, you know, here we are, we're about 9 years out from the decennial census, and so if there have been population shifts and demographic changes in the county, we want to be able to account for that and say if the jury pool for some reason looks different from the 2000 census figures, is that because the jury pool is not representative, or is it because the demographics of the county have changed that dramatically? And certainly in some communities throughout the United States, there have been, you know, very dramatic differences over the past 10 years, 9 years. Looking at this and realizing that jurors only reported for service on 7 days in April, so we're not talking about a huge sample, but from what I was looking with those census figures, I'm not seeing a problem in any respect in terms of the demographic representation of the jury pool. One thing that I did do with both the Asian and the Hispanic populations was that I did control for U.S. citizenship and I did control for English language fluency. The U.S. Census Bureau data, the 2000 decennial census, does allow you to do those calculations. The 2005-2007 allows you to control for citizenship, but not for English language fluency. But I did both for the 2000, and I did for citizenship on the 2005-2007 three-year average. And what I was seeing was that the minority populations across all of them, when we're looking at this, what do we mean by really underrepresented? And they are especially Asian, African American, are slightly underrepresented. African American was underrepresented by 1.2%, which means that the difference between what the U.S. Census Bureau said was the African American population, what the jury pool was off by 1.2 percentage points off of the 2000 census data, and it was off by 1.4% for the 2005-2007. That's fairly typical of large urban areas. Legally, I'm used to seeing disparities pretty consistently between 2 and 4% in most urban jurisdictions, and so being off by 1 to 2% does not trouble me that much at all. Usually when you start talking about what constitutes a real legal constitutional violation is when you start seeing differences of 10 percentage points or more. So that was the Black and African American. The Asian population, keeping in mind that the total population is only about between 3 and 4%, depending on which time period you're looking at. We had a grand total of 3 people in the pool who were of Asian race in April. So it was a little underrepresented, between 2 and 3 percentage points underrepresented. Again, that certainly doesn't rise to the level of a serious legal concern. And keeping in mind, you're only talking, if there had been 4 instead of 3, those numbers would have been dramatically different. So that's kind of the upshot there. Again, also with Hispanic, you're talking about very small numbers. But again, controlling for Hispanic and Asian, we were talking about less than 1% disparities. And so in terms of the demographics, I was not troubled at all.
Okay, we have, Mr. Brown have a question. Can you hear me pretty good, Ms. Hannaford?
I can hear you. I couldn't hear other people in the room.
No, you probably have to repeat questions.
Okay.
So you'll have to repeat questions, I think.
Yes.
I have a general question. One, I know you've worked with a lot of different counties doing this sort of analysis, and I was wondering if you had other counties you worked with that had the same two-tiered system where we send out the questionnaire first and it gets returned, and then if it's returned, we send out the summons.
The question is in relationship to other counties that have a two-tiered system where they send out, you know what that means.
Where you do the qualification first and then the summoning?
Right, yes, ma'am.
Mm-hmm.
And if so, have you seen any decrease or any difference in response rates or participation in general and specifically participation by minorities?
Okay, these are some long questions for me. So he says, have you seen any, say one more time, let me break it down a little bit.
Any difference or change in response rates?
Any differences or changes in response rates
before they started the two-tier system?
Before they started the two-tier system.
What we do see and what we've seen, and this is based on a national study that that my organization did that was published a couple of years ago, we do know that the two-step system is usually much less efficient than a one-step system. Usually by the time you go through the qualification process and then get around to summoning, for some reason it doesn't seem that first qualification step works terribly well. for example, we'll see some of the qualification questionnaires will get sent back as deliverable, but then there's such a time lag that by the time you start summoning them, the people that were previously qualified have since moved, and so then the summons has come back undeliverable. So you have sort of this accretion of losing people. We also see that with non-response and failure to appear rates, and for some reason, which never really made sense to me, but and I don't know whether it's that the information is bad on the qualification questionnaire, but we would often see people who are being summoned who are, presumably have already passed muster and they are qualified for jury service. And then when you send the summons to them, you find out that they're not qualified for service and they end up being disqualified. So it's a process that is less efficient. Typically what we see, we talk about jury yield, how many pieces of mail, qualification questionnaires and summonses, do you need to send out to be able to get, one live human qualified juror reporting for service? Nationally, that's about 1 in 2. Typically, the yield is about 50%. What we see with the two-step is, depending upon, other issues that are going on in the community, that instead of being a 50% yield, it's usually closer to a 40% yield. You're usually losing about 10% extra just by having that two-step system. So it's less efficient. Depending upon other factors in the community, sometimes that the two-step system can contribute to underrepresentation of minorities, but not necessarily at all. It really has to do an awful lot with, a lot of other factors in the community, including what is your overall composition to start with. Does that answer your question?
He's nodding yes. I think he did.
Good.
I think he had another question.
Yeah. I have kind of a specific question about the statistic, the significances that were marked on this process. Maybe I should just email her.
Well, maybe you can bring it up here, I guess.
He
has a little more of a specific question about one of the statistics. And Mr. Brown has a tremendous amount of experience in this area. Well, he has some experience, and I don't know how much, but here he is now.
Yeah, I'm not real talking
about the microphone.
Can you hear me okay?
I'm with you.
Okay. I'm not a statistician, but I do a lot of GIS work, and I'm familiar with statistics. And I was looking at the spreadsheets you sent, and one of them is called the process. Are you familiar with that one?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And you marked red and blue. I don't have it in front of me.
Okay. So this is the one that was broken down by
zip
code?
Right.
Okay.
So you marked this
pull
one.
Pull that out so I'm looking at the same one that you are. I've got all my copies here. Mm-hmm.
It highlighted in red which ones were significantly underrepresented, and I think blue was overrepresented.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, when you're calculating your significance, it looked to me, just by looking at it, that you were using the total population as the expected rate for everything.
Actually, what I did was I based it on whatever the previous
okay.
Whatever the previous step was.
That was my question.
So, with total population to master jury list and looking at where there was under overrepresentation there, then looking at the qualification rate versus the master jury list, and then all four of them, undeliverable, non-response, disqualified, qualified, as compared to the qualification questionnaire, which you would expect to see differences there. Then looking at the summons as compared to the qualification rate, reported as the summons, and you would expect to see some difference there. And then the jury pool, which was based on the surveys that were done.
Okay. So
I was doing it as basically what was the previous step, and so as baseline for each one of those statistical analyses.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure a difference in hope and in the math area that wasn't propagating down.
No, this would have been, again, it sort of, it shifts depending upon what the previous step was. But if you look at the actual statistics, you know, the qualification questionnaires to the master jury list, you know, you get very large sample sizes, especially, I think Champaign is the big one that sort of pops out at you there. And so it's much more sensitive in terms of the differences because you are working with such large population sizes there. But if you look at the actual percentage, your qualification questionnaires are 16.04% compared to 16.15%. These are not numbers, you know, these are not differences that trouble me terribly. If I saw something that was like the master jury list said 16% and the qualification questionnaire said 20%, I would be concerned about that, that there was something going on with the way that the random selection was going, that it was missing lots of people. But when it's less than a percentage point there, really less than, you know, barely 0.1 percentage point, that does not trouble me all that terribly much.
Yeah, I think that's why I was kind of surprised about the significant. I thought maybe you were comparing to the population.
Yeah, that is, that would be certainly, and that's a very valid question to be asking. But no, this one I'm doing, what was the immediately preceding stage of the jury process was my baseline for doing the comparison.
And then, so the jury pool, would that be compared then to reported or just to
I was comparing the jury pool to the, I'd actually have to look at the program. But I'm fairly certain that it was doing it to the summons. That the pool and the reported are the same people. It's just that the reported represents a full year of data, and the jury pool is just the month of April.
Okay. I think that answers it.
Thanks. Okay. Ms. Hannaford, my question was in relationship to, you said the two steps process usually loses about 10% and it possibly lessens the response of the African American community given in certain circumstances. What would those circumstances be and why is that so?
Well, where we see, the two factors that tend to work in it works on all minority populations. Mostly we see it in most communities in the United States, it's African American. In some communities, it tends to be more Hispanic. Two, and it's really related to socioeconomic status. It ends up being, you know, the visual result, if you will, is in the race. But what it's really targeting is socioeconomic status. Undeliverable rates and failure to respond rates are probably the two biggest ones that we see that can skew the racial demographics of the jury pool. And so when you have higher than normal undeliverable rates, typically it's because your lower income people move more often, they're you know less likely to stay in the same place, they're often less likely to inform the post office that they have moved in a timely manner. And so you end up with a disproportionately high proportion of undeliverable summonses and or qualification questionnaires coming back from lower socioeconomic neighborhoods, which unfortunately in this country is very highly correlated with minority populations, African American, Hispanic, to a lesser extent Asian. That depends an awful lot on the characteristics of the community.
Okay, thank you.
So you do get this sort of accretion when there's a two-step. I mean, you get it in one step as well, where you have a high undeliverable rate and it would tend to essentially bleed off minority populations. You get the same thing with failure to appear. Again, it's being driven by socioeconomic. When people have done studies of failure to appear or failure to respond rates, and have controlled for socioeconomic factors, the race effects disappear entirely. So a lower income white person and a lower income black person or a lower income Hispanic person are all equally as likely to not appear for jury service. But because of the demographics and the correlation between lower income status and minority, what you see is a wider jury pool.
Okay.
as a result of that.
Mr. Hoffman, I have a question.
So you have both of those factors going in, and the fact that when you have a two-step versus a one-step, you've got two opportunities to basically lose the minorities in your pool, as opposed to just one where you can sort of, you're more likely to keep them in.
Okay, Ms. Hannaford, Mr. Holland has a question for you also.
I actually have a comment. I have a comment and a question. The comment is one of the reasons why we went to probably the primary reason why we went to the two-step system is that we used to have summonses in a one-step system sent out for 2-week terms once a month, and our return rate was about 25%, as opposed to the rate that we're getting now, which is much higher, because we're going from questionnaires of people who already come back as qualified. So our return rate was worse before than it is now.
Can you hear that, Ms. Hannaford, what he just said?
So what you're saying is when you went from a one-step to a two-step?
That's correct.
To improve your yield?
That is correct, and it has.
And it has, okay. Well, your overall yield or just your summoning yield?
I think the summoning yield has gone up.
Okay. From an operational perspective, with your summoning yield, the thing that if you're the jury manager and you're responsible for having, a minimum of 50 people to send up to the judge in the courtroom on Monday morning, what you're concerned about is what's the probability that they're all going to show up. And so if you have a lot of variability in your yield, that can be a real concern. When you're doing the qualification yield, what you want to look at is both your qualification yield and your summoning yield. So your summoning yield may be higher because you've already found these people and you've already qualified them. But your overall yield is probably lower than what it was because what you need to do is take your qualification yield, which is 56%, and then your summoning yield, which is looking like 52%. And multiply the two of them. So I would suspect that your overall yield hasn't changed all that much. It just means that you've got a better your summoning yield has gone up, but you're already controlling for your qualification yield. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and that may quite possibly be true.
Okay.
My question is, have your studies in other places included cities that have major colleges in them? One of the theories that we've had about the unreturned questionnaires is that perhaps we are targeting students who are much more transient than normal members of the community. Do you have any experience with that, or do you think that in any way influenced your the analysis of the data?
It might account for some of them. I'm not sure to what, you would be more informed about this than I would, to what extent your students, are they living in dorms? Are they registering to vote there in Champaign? Are they getting their driver's license, or are they maintaining their voting status and driver's license in wherever their home community was before they came to college. If they are actually registered to vote and getting their driver's license, and so technically should be showing up on the master jury list, then certainly that would account for an awful lot of your undeliverables. They're probably moving, every minimum 9 months, 9 to 12 months. And so they would be harder to keep track of. But I'm not sure, and maybe the college registrar could give you some insights about that, of how many of them are actually should be showing up on your voters list.
Thank you.
And I think that was something was it Bill Brown?
Yes.
When we had some email correspondence going on earlier this year, right after I first sent my initial analyses to Mr. Holland, he made the point, and I thought it was exactly right, that when the decennial census was done and the American Community Survey is probably overrepresenting those communities on campus because they are actually looking at the, for the purposes of the census, that's where those people live. They don't, the census counts them where those people happen to be living on April 1st, and it wasn't counting them at their home.
Okay, we have one other question. Ms. Avery?
Sure.
Can you ask the question whether or not there is any software where the jury pools are randomly selected by census clerks?
Did you hear that, Ms. Hannaford?
I could hear part of it. Could you repeat it?
Yes. Is there any software where the jury pool is selected randomly by census?
Census Tract.
By Census Tract.
By Census Tract? There are a couple of communities that I know of that have attempted to do that, some more successfully than others. Back in the late 1980s and the early 1990s, Wayne County, Michigan was doing that, where they were essentially doing proportional representation based on, I don't know that it was census tract. I'm trying to remember what, it may have been zip code. And then there's another Contra Costa County in California that does some oversampling of some of their communities where they've essentially programmed the software to oversample in response to compensate for non-response rates. And so as a practical matter, what it means is that they are oversampling from their larger minority communities. So it's possible to do that. I think most software could be doing it. The whole idea is sort of, but you're specifically randomly sampling. I mean, it doesn't matter. If it's truly random, it should be randomly sampling from any geographic unit that you were talking about, whether it's census tract, whether it's zip code, whether it's locality, whether it's, I mean, you can get right down to the census block. I just finished a large project for Los Angeles County where we were working with, you know, quite literally about 50,000 different census blocks on the county and looking at the different populations and whether, you know, and I think they had about a grand total of about 30 census blocks that were overrepresented and 21 that were underrepresented. So it was, you know, it was definitely random.
Did you know what the response rate was from those trials? I don't know if there were trials or if that's something that they currently are still doing.
Do you know what the response rates were for those two particular incidents you just described to us?
Unfortunately, the Detroit, the Wayne County, was before I started getting involved in this area, so I don't know exactly how successful that was. There have also been a number of institutional changes there where they took the city of Detroit, it was called the Recorder's Court, and unified it with all of the circuit courts throughout Michigan and throughout the county. So you no longer really had a city of Detroit specific court. You can go to the Detroit Free Press and just Google, you know, jury pool, and there's a host of stories about problems that they've had there. We were actually called in as an expert witness on a jury challenge there. They have not been successful, but they have a very long history of not being successful with managing the jury pool. I know in Contra Costa that the oversampling that they were doing was very successful. But one of the things that I've sort of cautioned about is that you have to monitor those systems very, very carefully when you're doing that, because things can shift over time. And unless you are, you know, literally looking on a month-by-month basis, or do we have it programmed correctly with exactly, you know, what percentage we need to be oversampling from this zip code as compared to that zip code, and continually updating that process, then you can end up, you know, basically slipping flipping and exacerbating underrepresentation. The ABA, you know, recognizes that this is a valid technique. It can work when other things don't work, but it's usually a mechanism of last resort because it does require so much extra supervision.
Okay, Mr. Holland had one other question.
And it's actually a follow-up to what you just said. We sent you a couple of questions right after your initial analysis came back, one of which was about possible oversampling of certain areas of the community, and you seemed to tell a very cautionary tale about doing that. I was wondering if you could expand a little bit on that and say why that technique, one of the partially just described, is so, I guess, not dangerous, not the word, but risky.
Well, there were a couple of issues. One is, if you're going to do it, you need to be non-discriminatory about it. So you have to have, where I've seen it, where it's been able to pass constitutional equal protection muster, it's done geographically as opposed to race. And so if you were to say, okay, we want to compensate for our non-response rate, and this is where I said you need to monitor it because if all of a sudden if something changes and those response rates change, then you can end up exacerbating it. But you have to do, okay, if there's one community has a non-response rate of 20%, say, and another one has a non-response rate of 10%, then what you need to do is oversample from the one that has the 20% to compensate, but then you want to oversample by 10% in the other locality so that you're doing this in a very race-neutral way and a very transparent way. That's one of the issues. The other issue, and I think this is probably particularly important for Champaign County, because if I remember, there's not really any, at least at the zip code level that I looked at, there were not really any particular zip codes that had majority or even supermajority, which is ideally what you would like to see, of a particular demographic other than white. And so what can happen, because if you remember from my previous comments about the correlation between non-response and undeliverables in minority populations, if, for example, if you get a zip code that's 70% white and 20% black and 10% Asian, and you say, okay, we're concerned about this, we want to oversample from that population to try and compensate for underrepresentation or in coming from that particular zip code. What you can do is if you're randomly, you know, sending out you know, extra qualification questionnaires, when you have that type of a demographic, you know, you're oversampling, you are going to be sending out 70% of your oversample, if you will, to white households. If your random selection is working, 70% are going to be oversampled and sent to white households, 30% of your oversampling will, or 20% will be sent to black, 10% to Asian. And if you have a differential non-response rate, which is very typical, what you will end up doing is actually exacerbating the situation where your whites in that locality, again, will respond and qualify at higher rates than the blacks, and you will end up with an even more disproportionate jury pool than you had before. So where I've seen it work was, for example, in the city of Detroit, and the city of Detroit is overall is 80% black, and the 20% that is white, you know, there's really like two zip codes in all of out of 40 zip codes in the city of Detroit that are predominantly white, and all the rest of them are, you know, 90% or higher black. And so that one is one where it works very, very well because the probabilities of, you know, if we're sending questionnaires to these predominantly black neighborhoods, we can be fairly certain that any responses we get are going to be coming from predominantly black jurors. When you've got a more mixed neighborhood, and certainly if you have a predominantly white neighborhood, unless there's some other socioeconomic socioeconomic issues going on, for example, a very transient student population, you could actually end up with a wider jury pool than you would otherwise have.
Okay, well.
Did that make sense?
Yep, it sure did.
To those of us who understand it, I think some of it is a little confusing to most of us, but I think we get the overall gist of it. I think Judge Pontus has a question for you.
If we were to try to improve our racial component of the jurors that actually show up, do you suggest we go back to the single-step system of just sending out the summonses as opposed to what we do now, the two-tier system?
Well, certainly, I think going to a one-step process would improve your efficiency overall. I was very surprised, and I did note that your non-response to the qualification questionnaires were very high, certainly compared to other circuit courts in Illinois, and frankly to sort of similar-sized courts in other counties around the state. Normally what we see at the non-response rate is usually about 9%, and I think if I remember correctly, it was closer to about 35% was what we had from the data from 2008. And so I'm not sure what you are currently doing to follow up on non-response on your qualification questionnaires, and if you did it if you went to a one step, you would want to do it both on non-response and failure to appear. But because what we know is a very, very strong correlation between minority status and failure to appear in non-response rates, that would be my first recommendation, is to put in place some type of a follow-up program to try and locate those people and get them to respond to the questionnaire. The research that we've done suggests that the single most effective mechanism for doing that is simply a second notice or a second summons, and done very quickly after the person was supposed to have responded, usually within about 3 weeks. So if somebody was supposed to send back a qualification questionnaire within 20 days, give them another 2 weeks to, account for mail, or somebody's been, out on vacation or a business trip or something. But then start sending out those things with a second questionnaire saying, hey, we're supposed to get this from you. It's really important that you send this back. One of the things, there's a very good study that was done of non-response by the American Judicature Society back in, I think it was published in 1998. And the major finding that came out of that study, there were a number of things that sort of distinguish people who will respond to a jury summons from those that don't. Interestingly enough, race was not one of them. It really did come down to socioeconomic status. But the single biggest factor was the expectation of the person of whether or not something would happen to them if they didn't respond to the jury summons. And so when you have a court that doesn't follow up and doesn't follow up in a very timely basis, essentially it validates that expectation of, hey, this doesn't matter, they don't care, they're not going to miss me, and so I'm just going to put this on the corner of my desk and forget that it exists. And obviously if they don't make it on the qualification list, then they can't ever be summoned, so they can't actually end up, reporting for jury service, and so you miss those people entirely. So the ones that we've seen that have an effective follow-up, and usually it's that second notice, and it's done on a timely basis, and, we're really serious, and these are the consequences that if you don't do it, that typically, depending upon the community, will reduce the non-response rate anywhere from 24% to 46%. It's a very, very effective one, saying, we do know that you didn't respond, and we're going to give you another chance, and you can talk about more aggressive measures after that with order to show cause or sending out the warrants, and those are a whole other issue. And it's not clear that other than for PR benefits of sort of getting that as a public public awareness campaign, that they're that effective in terms of lowering it. So the follow-up notice is extremely effective.
So you would suggest that not only is you send the follow-up notice, but possibly a letter to go along with it that would suggest it's very important if you haven't filled it out, gotten it, and we really need this back. I mean, something more personal to the individual who has it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. But it's got to be timely. And if you want to batch them once a month, so, you know, we expected to get, you know, these 200 back, and we only got 100 back, so we're only got 50, you know, there's 50 of them that are still out there. You know, personalize the letter, send a second copy of the qualification questionnaire. Typically what you see in terms of the yield on that second time of doing that, and I would expect it would be at least this good, I mean, you get a very high non-response rate there. Is that the yield on the second notice is typically the same as the one on your first notice. So I would expect that if you sent out 200 qualification questionnaires, you know, of which 100 come back qualified, but you've got that, you know, 60 or so that are just not being responded to, I would fully expect that on that second one, you would get another 30 more bodies that are qualified that you could put on your qualified list based on your yield, at least.
We did, Paula, try that briefly to see if that worked, and we actually got very little response back, surprisingly. It wasn't a long-term study or anything like that, but we did attempt to send out secondary questionnaires to those who did not respond the first time, and we got very few responses back. So it may be something that we have to look into as far as doing it for a longer period of time to see if it works, but our initial attempts did not produce the yields that we would have liked.
Was there anything, when you did that, was there anything you could tell about your, I mean, were they, did it look like they were students, or was it, you know, randomly distributed around the, around your, you know, the county? Anything you could tell from the date of birth about the age?
We really didn't analyze them. We were just hoping that, that when we got them back, that we would see that there was a 50% or so that you talk about, and it just didn't pan out that way. There was no real analysis of exactly who the people were that we sent second notices to.
Just looking at this jury process chart that I did, I mean, where it seems to be the highest, you know, statistically highest, is the two zip codes in Champaign, 820 and 821, and is it Rantoul?
Yes.
Okay. Those are the ones where you get the statistically highest non-response rates. Keeping in mind that, I mean, they're very high overall and, you know, across the board, those two are just particularly high, you know, where it's a statistical difference, but it's certainly not driving it for the entire county. And so if it's, you know, if you're fairly certain that most of your student population are actually, I mean, that may be driving some of the numbers in Champaign, but I wouldn't expect that they would be in Rantoul, and certainly, you know, not significantly in other parts of the county.
Well,
so it might be worth, you know, trying, and I don't know if you've still got access to those data, of just going back and trying to see if, you know, the people that you're still missing, is there anything that you can tell about them? Because just from the data that I had here, I wasn't seeing it outside of, you know, the two zip codes in Champaign and the Rantoul. And those were statistically higher, but they weren't accounting for the entire, you know, 34%.
I think we probably would be better off or better served trying it on a wider scale and seeing and then analyzing the data at that point, instead of trying to go back in time, because I'm not exactly sure how long ago this was. It was quite early. In fact, I believe it was right after I heard you speak at the meeting of the chief judges, so it's been that long ago. I think it would be better to do
that. One thing that I did notice, because your undeliverable rate, at least what's in the system, is extraordinarily low. Typically, we see that as, you know, usually it's about 13 to 15% in most urban areas. And that's, you know, when you think that the mobility rate nationally is about 15%, 15% of households move each year, that, you know, catching up to those folks is kind of difficult. It made me think, and this just occurred to me, you know, after the series of emails that went back and forth back in May, that perhaps if you are not logging in people who are sending, you know, where you're getting the summonses back, but they're not actually being updated in the computer to show that they're undeliverable. So a lot of those non-response might be actually undeliverables. And if you're not, I don't know if, do you all use judicial systems?
Yes.
I don't know if they are using NCOA to update the addresses on a regular basis.
We are. We wash everything through the National Change of Address database.
Okay. So that's, you know, that might be something to look into, is just, you know, do you have more of those that are coming back as undeliverable, and they're just sort of continuing in the system as non-response because they haven't been updated?
Yes.
Might be something to look into, but like I said, even with that, I mean, even if some of those were coming back as non-response, if you're using NCOA, you're already doing the one thing that I would recommend that a lot of courts overlook, that it's still being driven by your, you would still have a very, very high non-response rate. And so looking at follow-up on that, and then, you know, possibly it's a very, very long slog, but looking at a larger public outreach, you know, importance of jury service, working with community groups and trying to, you know, emphasize and educate the population about the importance of jury service.
We're working on that right now.
Okay. Well, good. You're doing everything right then.
Well, Ms. Hannaford, I don't think if there are no more pressing questions, concerns, we won't intrude on your time anymore. There's one question.
Has it been relayed, the court watching study that found that African Americans represent 6% of the jury pool in Champaign County?
That's not scientific. That's people sitting there looking at you saying.
Has that been relayed to Ms. Hannaford? Is the question?
I don't know if she's aware. We're talking about a study that was done by some students here, by one of the law professors, that gives a correlation that says that black population is 6%
of the jury.
Of the jury.
When they represent roughly 15% in Champaign or 12% in Champaign County. So we're wondering, how is it that in this unscientific study, African Americans are 50% underrepresented, and yet the discrepancy that Ms. Hannaford found was like a 1.2%. So I'm not saying that, you know, either study is more right than the other, but how would there be such a wide discrepancy between the two studies?
Well, if I remember correctly, and this is just anecdotal, that the Champaign Urbana Law School, they were basically doing an eyeball, which is probably the most unreliable way of judging race and ethnicity that there is. I think that was one of the issues. Basically, you want to measure race and ethnicity the same way that the Census Bureau does, which is you ask people to self-disclose. So Census Bureau sends out the decennial census form, and you say, you know, I am white, I am black, I am Asian, I am Hispanic, I'm a citizen, I'm not a citizen, and you answer all of the questions. And so that's exactly what we were doing in terms of the survey in the jury pool, was using the exact census definitions and asking jurors to self-disclose. We got a very high response rate there. So given that, you know, I think that's definitely a more reliable way of measuring. The other issue, and I didn't see the actual report, but it struck me that I thought I had heard that the students were also using total population figures as opposed to the jury eligible population. So they weren't controlling for age, they weren't controlling for citizenship, they weren't controlling for English language. Unfortunately, through census, you can't control also for felony conviction that's not a disqualification in Illinois, so that's not even applicable here. But those can have a very, very significant effect in terms of what the composition of your jury eligible population looks like as compared to your total population, just because of the impact of differential birth rates between minority and white populations. Citizenship rates and English language fluency. And so their baseline may have not been as accurate, and if they were using sort of an eyeball, I think this person is black, I'm looking at the surname, I think this person is Hispanic, is not terribly reliable, and not as reliable as what you were doing here. One thing that I did notice too is that they tended to break it down. I thought they were also breaking it down by gender, both by race, by gender. Were they also doing it by age?
Yes.
And so you're talking about some very small numbers and trying to judge. I mean, I'm not fool enough to try and decide whether, you know, somebody is, you know, what age they are, because I'm invariably wrong. And so I think that was also probably distorting the results. You don't see in terms of a legal challenge, you know, you would never do that on anything except, you know, what you could actually measure and have a reliable baseline on, which is census. And that's the gold standard, so.
All right, thank you very much for your time. We do appreciate it, and I'm sure...
You're very welcome. And please feel free if anyone has additional questions that come up. You know, I'm happy. I'm an email away, so...
Okay. Thank you, Paula. All right, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Have a very nice weekend.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Yes, Mr. Wiley.
A question. How long have we used the two-tier system?
A couple of years now.
A couple of years. And one of the things that she suggested on the follow-up is, I guess, our follow-up that we did for a brief period of time, just a second request on the envelope. She suggests a letter almost, personalized, but a letter inside that saying, basically, you didn't return the questionnaire. Again, it's incredibly important, and I've put together a letter that we're going to send out with our questionnaires, but I think her idea of letting, well, like you said, if they feel there's no consequence,
right,
just let it go. You don't care. It's obvious if you don't care, so why do I care?
Well, Ms. Kessel also talked about that in Chicago, that they would basically almost send a warrant out for you. Now, I'm not suggesting that we go that far, but the culture is that this is important, that you will respond. It's not a just kind of, you know, it's not important type of thing. So I think that was an important point that was made that I got out of it. And then there was something else that came. I had a question about the second questionnaire. Thank you. How would it affect the current continuous jury system? Would it would it affect it in any way, shape, or form? It wouldn't.
Only if they, I mean, obviously if they were, if the second time we send it with a letter, they send it back, and then our pool is that much bigger.
Mm-hmm. So it can only help?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
If it works, right? There would be some cost involved in the postage and the paper and whatnot, but if it works, we should definitely try it.
Okay.
I think we definitely have that.
Take a look at the letter that I drafted. That's only
the third page.
It's only the draft. And for our next meeting, feel free if you want to make some changes to it. And if you think it might be appropriate to include, well, I think we would have to do a second letter for the follow-up.
Okay. I have, I guess, derelict in my duties. I did not... open this meeting properly. I didn't do anything, and Jenny Putman is going to get on me about this.
Oh,
Yeah, that's right.
Well, I kind of maybe think the mess.
Yeah, we were trying to get this happening on the phone at 5:30 and it was raining.
Yeah, she's an hour ahead of us.
Friday, talk about something.
She told me that she was going to be drinking wine in her pajamas when she was on the phone with us, so I'm hoping that it wasn't too bad.
So, basically, we've already called it to order. We have, I guess we can do a roll call just for the minutes.
Well, I just looked around and I noticed,
you got them?
There were three late entrants, me being one, and the others, no, three are. We're so glad that you came. There were two people absent, Lorraine and Patrick Thompson, and we're so pleased to have.
And Barbara Kessel.
And Barbara was, she's out of state. Right. She informed us that she would have to be away.
Okay.
And this is, we're so pleased to have our public defender here and all of the court officers.
This is our wonderful public participant who never participates publicly. So we don't have that as do we have an approval of the minutes, though, from July 24th?
I've mailed these to people in Atlanta, and it is a draft only. And if the power of the pen can be mightier than it ought to be, or the power of the electronic keyboard. If I have, I'm relying on you to read these minutes and point out errors or misinterpretation.
Did anyone have? Has everyone had a chance to read the minutes? So I think there are no issues. So I guess we can vote to approve the minutes.
Second motion.
Motion by Ms. Avery, second by Mr. Turner. All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? The ayes have it. And so public participation. We've had the conference call. And then we were to have some presentation done also by...
We didn't approve the agenda.
Oh, I skipped that somehow. I'm learning. So do we have a motion to approve the agenda? Has everyone had a chance to look at it?
Second.
Moved by DeFontis, second by Gladney. All in favor?
I'm sorry, discussion.
Discussion.
there were some items that I hoped to include to add, and I emailed them to you a couple days ago.
Yes, ma'am.
And one was to add a major heading called Old Business. And then under New Business, to specify establishment of a working group to produce under old business, we should have a follow-up on the letter that we received from Neil Parkman. Under old business, I would like help in interpreting how the statute that Mr. Holland sent us, that's ILS 3051, I have a question about how that applies in our county. And then Mr. Judge DeFontis has already done this to issue and segue into the discussion of revision of the questions on the jury qualification questionnaire. I'd like those items added to the agenda.
Okay. I think that's
appropriate. I move the addition of those items to the agenda.
So the motion is made to add the items to the agenda. Is there a second to that?
Did they remove their?
So the motion to amend is accepted, and so all in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? All right. Brian's learning some stuff.
I'm trying to keep up. I want to hear Bill's presentation tonight. But I don't want to keep us, you know, too late in the evening. Can we handle all this tonight on the agenda, the couple of additions?
Yes, we can.
Well, I think the...
for a working group and discussion of the state statute, can we handle all that tonight?
Well, there's only one way to find out. If I get too late and we lose a quorum and we don't go after it.
About
7
o'clock on
that
meeting.
Maybe it would be smart then to first do the item on the revisions to the jury qualification questionnaire, since Judge Stefan is good enough to bring that draft to it. Maybe, is that your opinion as well?
How much of the presentation going to take, though? Probably at least 10 minutes, maybe 20 minutes.
I would like to, take home the questionnaire revision to look at.
I concur.
And we and he put some effort into the putting the viewing us, and I'd like to see that too. So we'll have another meeting.
Yes, ma'am. Same.
So can we just then for the next meeting for the agenda items that we were just recording for this agenda? Make sure that they are.
Yes.
Okay.
So we're going to have the presentation now by Mr. Yes, Mr. Dollar.
I just want to make one brief statement for our support bill. I'll make a brief. And I'll say it because I want to say this before Judge DeFontis leaves, is that this is not the courtroom. Judge DeFontis is not the God here. We're very thankful for all of your input here. But we are all citizens, as you even acknowledged in one of the first meetings. We're all citizens here. So when I present questions to Ms. Hannaford, and you...
You're right, I jumped to what I should not have done that. You're absolutely correct.
Thank you.
But then you and I do have a history. But I will try to keep it. I do apologize. You're absolutely correct. I should not have done that.
We can talk about the history outside of it.
You're right.
Okay, so Mr. Brown is going to make his presentation.
Okay. So what I had was
talking to the microphone, please. Oh.
Can you hear me now? What I had was basically two data sets. One was the total summonses that were sent out. And then we recently got another data set that I haven't mapped yet, and that was the non-response. So with those two data sets, you still can't really determine the response rate. You have how many summonses were actually sent out and how many people didn't respond to questionnaires. So there's a few different things. If I get one more data set where the total questionnaires set out, then I can probably calculate a response rate geographically. So what I wanted to do was basically go through the steps of mapping the summonses, and then I also mapped the zip code data that we had from Paula, so we can look at that too. And I also will explain just a little bit of the steps of the mapping process, and I have a few slides on census data in general, just so you can be familiar a little bit more with what the census units are. So this first map just shows Champaign-Urbana on the left and Champaign County on the right with the dots. These are basically households where people were summoned. So this gives you an overall view of it looks like it's pretty much where you would expect the population to be. That's about all you can tell from that one. And then, I'm just going to go through real briefly a little bit about census data and how it differs from zip code data. Basically, we call these geographic units, and they're all different sizes, and they have different characteristics. The zip codes in Champaign County, there's 29 zip codes. If you're looking at census tracts, there's 41 tracts. And then they break it down farther than that. So the tracts here are in red. They break it down farther than that to block groups in green, and that consists of anywhere from a handful, maybe 6 to 20 city blocks. And that's a real convenient level to work at, block groups, because it incorporates enough people where you get a pretty good sample. On average, a block group is about 1,000 people. But it's not so small like blocks where you run into real statistical problems with not enough samples. So you might see that a little bit more later.
When you say 100 people,
about 1,000 people in a block group.
Or household.
This is people.
1,000 people.
In a block group. And this
I'll just kind of skip over. It's a distribution of, if you're interested in statistics, the top one is tracks, the middle one is block groups, and the bottom one is blocks. And it shows you kind of how much variation there is in the population of these different units. So in tracks, there's a pretty big variation in the population. In block groups, there's not as much. And in blocks, it doesn't look like there's as much on that chart, but the chart goes up to like 2,000. But it ranges from 1 to 2,000. And blocks, it's almost the worst unit to work at for statistical purposes because there is just a lot of variation. And just a little bit more about what Paula was talking about with the census is using old data can be problematic, especially around the edges of the city. And you actually see that in some of the maps where there's been growth around the edges of Champaign, and that throws off the statistics. And I can show you what that looks like when we look at the maps. The new census will be in April of next year. That's when they'll actually do the counting, and that's where you're living in April is where they'll count you. But they won't release any track level data for that for about a year. So it would be basically 2 years from now before we get enough data to actually do a new analysis. So we basically have to live with what we get from the 2000 census. Plus, like she was saying, they do the sample data, 2005-2007, but they only do that at a higher unit. They only do that at like municipal level. They don't do that at the block group or block, so we can't analyze it down to the detail that we can with 2000 census. So we really just have to go with 2000 census and adjust for what we know about the population.
Maybe we had a question.
Is it okay if we ask questions during the presentation? And there has been a couple that I'm aware of, it could be more, of these special census that are taken. How do you account for those?
Yeah, I do have one map that will show you the outline of the Urbana special census. I was able to get some data from that. But the problem is that, and that's good because it'll give you a new total for the city, but I haven't been real successful trying to integrate that with old data because they've counted partial blocks and partial block groups. And it's hard to see, like if you know that in a block group you have so many African Americans and they counted 25% of that block group again, you don't know where to put those people really. You don't know which ones come out, which ones go in. So it's hard to integrate that with real data. It's good for accumulating totals, but it's hard to really get a lot of good demographic information out of it. But it's something worth trying, and I'll look at that more.
I'm wondering if when we do the new census in 2010, will they recount those special census?
Yeah, they count everything. So here's a view of Champaign-Urbana with the dots where people were summoned from. And just the colors represent as a percent of the population. So you would expect 2.8% total overall for the county, and the colors range from 0% almost to up to 10%. And obviously it's mostly campus areas, and the other red spot up there is student housing up on North Lincoln. So it's mostly students in that one, but then the orange color, which comes out better up there than it was here, the orange color is also underrepresented. So that's about 1 to 2% of the people who were summoned that live in that area. And then the green areas on the far left, and then the lower southeast Urbana, those are mostly caused by that kind of deviation in the data I was talking about where it's growth areas. So there's actually more people living there now than the census thought there were. So we have it looks like a high response rate because of more people there now.
Bill, I just want to make sure I understand. Is this a graph of people who responded to summons or people who haven't?
This is the people who've been summoned. Okay.
So Bill, so that means that if people didn't respond or didn't deliver that person, they wouldn't have gotten this summons. So would the inference be that that's one of the questions was, are a lot of the undeliverables that non-responses from campus, the inference would be it might be that we're seeing a big red spot on campus.
Yeah, I think I agree with that.
But they're not even going to summons in the first place?
Well, no, this is only based on the summonses, but the summonses aren't going out to people who didn't respond or was undeliverable. So the inference can be made that since that big red spot is not on campus, a lot of people who are not responsive or undeliverable more from the campus area. Because you said we didn't analyze that data, but that can...
But that's assuming they got a questionnaire. That's the assumption there. We don't really know for sure that they got the questionnaire in the system.
That's true.
Ms. Putnam?
Well, this is confusing me, Bill, because I thought in order to be qualified to receive a summons, an individual needed to respond to the jury qualification questions. So they would have to have responded to that initial mailing.
Okay, what we're saying, though, is the underrepresented areas where the campus is, the red spots here, we don't know whether that's because they didn't respond to a mailing or they never received a mailing. If they weren't on the master list or for some reason it wasn't delivered, then they wouldn't have a chance to respond. So we can't tell from this whether it's because they just threw it away or because they didn't get the system.
Judge, what Ms. Canterford said about the campus population, I never gave that any thought, was a lot of the students come here and they keep their driver's license with their home address, wherever it might be.
Yeah.
They may very well be registered to vote back home. They don't exist as far as the information we get from the Secretary of State. What the Secretary of State gives us, driver's license, ID card, voter registration, and the handicapped thing. So we probably have a great number of students who, but as far as the Secretary of State's computer is concerned, aren't here.
In the case of a young person who is here, registers to vote here, but keeps her driver's license in another area, her name could be on our county clerk's list of registered voters and Jesse White's list of drivers from Cook County. So that person her name would appear as a voter. And she might also be summoned up in Chicago based on where she arrived.
And then she would have to take care of that situation up there, and then let us know that she's eligible for, really disabled or have you, or, whatever the case may be. I know that when I'm at school here, I never changed my driver's license, and I was registered to go to the district anywhere to sort of ask you.
So could that explain another reason why we've got a large non-response rate in that area?
Yeah. Not very many summonses in that area, and partially because, like you're saying, they probably weren't on the master list to begin with. Now, we can look at the actual non-response and it came back, and I do have that if we have time, just in the data sheet that you gave me. And what I did was I pulled out addresses of dormitories from the non-response list system, and there are some for some years, but not for others, so it's a little confusing what's going on there. Maybe if we have time, we can look at that. So this is just another way to look at this. This is age 18 and over. This is another thing that Paula was talking about that the law school didn't do. It's not a big difference. You can see it if I go back and forth there. That's age 18 and over, and that's the total population. And this is the non-citizen map. It's just the...
Leo, just a second. I think there's a question.
Yeah. Yeah, sorry. I might be being really late tonight, but you can only be on a jury if you're 18 or older.
Right. So it's just another way of looking at the numbers, because the law school, you have the total population, and that's where they got the 12.5% African American. If you look at the age 18 and over and citizenship and look at who's actually qualified, then you get about 9.5% African American for the county. So that's how Paula is coming up with smaller differences, basically. Plus, in her jury pool that she did for that week, she had 8.5% in the law school that was left. So there's differences that are significant and that are important, maybe not statistically significant. So I'm just kind of showing that it does make a little bit of a difference if you look at age 18 and over, the geographic distribution does look different. And then I also did the same thing with citizens. That's just a general map showing where the non-citizens live. That big section in the south is basically Orchard Downs. It's such a big block group. It's mostly farmland, so it looks big, but it's Orchard Downs, basically. It's a small section there. So then you take out the non-citizens, and then that red in Orchard Downs basically disappears because that's a dusted collection. Does that make sense? Okay. So that's the one I'm using as the Present Citizens for a couple of other maps. Oh, and this is just the overview of where the black population in Champaign-Urbana live. It's not real clear, but I think everybody's pretty familiar with that. And then here's that same map I showed you earlier, except the red lines, if you can see those, that's where the Urbana Special Census is taken. So the one up there on North Lincoln, and then mostly Southeast Urbana. So that's where Urbana thought basically there was growth, and probably is where most of the growth has occurred. So it also shows you that it's not a big portion of the county or the two towns. It's not something that you can use by itself. You have to integrate it with the rest of the data, and that's really hard to do.
Just for a second, I'm a poet, so maps don't do a whole lot. I ask a few questions. If we go back to the screen before, so what is that telling us? Is that just telling us where black people live?
Yeah, the dots are still the summonses, but the color, which didn't come out real good, but the darker the color there is a higher percent black. It's like a greenish color. So it ranges from up to about, actually the neighborhood right around Douglas Park is about 90% black, 95%. And then kind of, you know, you can see from there it's a little bit lighter as you go up toward Garden Hills, but it's still pretty high. And then the other high black population is near downtown Urbana, which might be the jail showing up in the census. I don't know. and then North Cunningham.
That's probably
what
it's asking.
Well, it should be the satellite
field. Yeah, I'm still trying to get my bearings.
So downtown Urbana's here. The satellite jail would be here.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of dark
Scott's
area there.
Prairie Green.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Scottswood and Prairie Green is like here, I think. Or Scottswood, Prairie Green. I forget what you call that. North side. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but those are summonses that were... Sure, right.
The dots are still summonses that were.
And so, what is this over since 2000? I mean, what is this?
What I did was I just pulled out 2008 for the summonses. Just looked at 1 year.
So this is 1 year.
The dots are. And I just overlay that.
You know how many people that was?
It's about 5,000. Does that sound right?
Yeah, I think it's right.
5,000 and 6,000. And what I also did, which I'm not real sure about after looking at some of the other duplicates. I took out all the duplicate summonses because we had duplicate addresses in the summons data. And I looked at them, and it didn't look like fraternities, which if there's fraternities, I'd leave it in there because it might be two different people.
Right.
It looked like houses mostly. So
it could be a husband and wife. So
could be.
In theory, it's possible, but I have not yet gotten to the bottom of what it is.
So there were some duplicates in there I took out.
You know, this was like one of those old monkey pictures where we had clips going through. It would be so interesting to see this particular map. Then this is our actual summons. Then the maps, and maybe you've got that, the ones that didn't qualify. And then breaking it further down, the actual ones that actually serve.
I don't have all that data, but that would be
That would show me if that would be a very good picture for me. And from that, you had an overlay. Okay, that were summons. Now here are the ones that actually qualify, and then here are the actual ones that actually serve.
Well, anyone who returned the
summons from the same area.
Anyone who returned the summons is qualified, right?
No.
If you return a questionnaire, you can indicate on there that you're not 18, that you're not a citizen, or that you're not a resident. That
well, I'm saying summons.
They'll return the summons. The summons get sent out to them, and tells them where they're supposed to come to court and when they're supposed to be.
Right, and that's what this is, summons, right?
Correct.
Okay, so I think what I heard you asking was how many of these people actually served on juries?
Right. Well, first, even more.
You have to go before this. You're saying we should go before this to the actual questionnaire sent out.
Questionnaire, summons, service.
Yes. And then you see where the dots are. So you either get maybe from a certain area, if they're, you know,
And there's no data that we collect about which jurors end up on which juries. And we don't have names or anything, but we don't collect the data on whether Roger Holland, when he goes, we know that he was there in court that day, but it's in the jury 2000 system. But we do not extract that. And obviously, our jury 2000 data does not include racial characters of any kind.
But we know where they're coming from. We know where some of them are coming from. Right. And we can actually see then from the data where they who actually served.
Right. We can tell you, served meaning that they were summoned to the courthouse and they may have gotten sent to a courtroom, maybe didn't, but it doesn't mean that what I'm trying to get at, it doesn't mean that they were sitting in the box actually as a juror, which is a little bit different than that's all the time.
So that wouldn't tell us that they actually served.
They would serve their jury service, but it doesn't mean that they were actually in the box as a juror.
So there's no data showing who was in the box, but the racial
right. demographics. I think there's nothing that's dragged out of that, exactly. I mean, when you get a summons, in the very corner is the badge, okay, which indicates where your number, a particular number, and that is scanned every day, and that's how we know who to pay for being there. So that information about who actually shows up at the courthouse is in the system, okay? But as far as, and then the system generates a list of those individuals at random who are here in the building, who then need, if Judge DePaz sees 40 jurors, the system spits out 40 and gives them a list of, at random in random order, and those jurors are then sent to Judge DePaz's courtroom. And then that list is counted down until they get their 12. You may go through all 40 to get 12. You may go through 15 to get 12, whatever it is.
I think that, I guess the overall objective, though, is that we've been doing this not just to increase the pool, but actually to increase the service, meaning actually in the box. Right.
So there's only so much we can do about that.
Right.
The attorneys basically, through the voir dire process, determine.
Right. I understand that. What I'm getting at is that I believe that is there a way for us to legally monitor or track who, by race, age, and gender, actually serves in the box?
Here's what I do, and I think the other judges do it also. Once I get a jury selected, even as people call them the box, I do what the court watcher does. I try to make a determination of the race of this individual, because it could be a year from now, 2 years from now, whatever. The defendant could say I was convicted, and by the way, the racial makeup of my jury dispute. But I'm doing the same thing. I'm going, okay. We can correlate the names with the questionnaire as to who's on that jury, so you know who it is, the age, where they came from. But as far as race, we don't have that information.
There's no self-disclosed opportunities,
right? Which is why we did the 1 month thing for Paula. We when the jurors came into the courthouse, we gave them a separate survey, which was circulated among everybody, to ask them specifically about what their race is. And then, as she said, 95% of those who came in voluntarily said, okay, I am this race. And that information was used in what she did with her analysis, which is why she says that's a much more reliable way of doing it than instead of me or somebody else looking at the individual and finding out.
And Randy, tries the cases, he makes the attorneys make the call on who they want to excuse and using peremptory challenges, and occasionally they will challenge the state if the state has excused someone who's African American and they think there's a discriminatory process going on.
I think most lawyers, I mean, when the jury comes into the room and there's 40 jurors, I get it from what they look. I look and I see, oh, there's 3 African Americans. You know, and I'm thinking, you know, okay, there's 3, and if one gets put in the box, I make sure the state doesn't knock them off, or you know, whatever. But I keep track, just on my notes, of who it is. But I suppose out of 40 people, that would end up being about 90% African American, which is what I guess the same is. And historically, I would say there's usually between 1 in 5 and, like, 2 or 4 would be about, what they say, But no, there is no official record. It's just what the lawyers, the judge, and the court watcher.
And that may be going too far for this committee. I was just wondering, you know, Ms. Putnam.
I thank Roger very much for giving us this one-page survey. I keep everything that I get from this committee. He sent this to us on May 11th.
Okay.
And I thank you for it.
And that came from Paula, by the way. We didn't make that up. That's what Paula recommended we use, and we use that exactly.
But there's nothing about this document that would keep this from being put in use immediately on every day, or for every, what is the terminology, for every jury pool, for every...
Well, every jury term would be a week.
Couldn't we start using this just to get this additional information?
Can we continue to pass out the questionnaire?
Right.
I think that would come back.
I was just going to say, I see nothing wrong with that.
And probably it just give us a continuing.
Right.
It'll give us a continuing idea if the numbers are dropping, if they're going up. Mm-hmm. Well, it'll give us an idea if after outreach we're making any progress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And maybe a better use of it to wait until after whatever efforts we're going to make with regard to outreach, and then see based on the 1 month that Paula did versus the. And the thing that is that, of course, as you know, when people send back questionnaires, I got a questionnaire recently, I sent it back. It doesn't mean that the next month you're going to be called for jury duty. It could be 6 months. It could be a much longer period of time. So there's no way, it's not necessary that the outreach people will be the next set of people for the next month. There's going to be some lag. So
that's what Kate did.
So there's going to be some lag in that.
Ms. Putnam has the floor, and I'm going to have to do my pie's wife on the team.
Yeah, I need to go. I'm sorry.
But we did this for 1 month only, and that was at Ms. Hannaford Abel's request. What was the month?
It was April this year.
April.
Every Monday, when a big group of jurors came in, whether it was 75, 80, or 90, that group got the questionnaire. So it was only on Mondays. I think we ran it for like 4 to 6 weeks.
I believe it was the month of April. She took that data and then used that in addition to the data that she extracted, which is much more data obviously, extracted from our jury 2000 system about who got sent questionnaires, who got sent summonses, and all of that, and that's what she used for that. And I really do have to go outside. If you have any questions, you can email me and I'll see you next week.
Bill, how much further do you have to go into your presentation?
I could just kind of go through it real fast, mostly just comparing some things. It'll be time in 5 minutes.
Go for it.
So this is what it would look like if we analyzed it at the track level instead of the block group level, so it's not as detailed. But you can still see the patterns there. You can see the underrepresentation in the orange and the red. And then I did the whole county.
Bill?
I'm sorry. We can ask some questions.
So, can you go look up? Well,
that one.
Yeah, that one. Yeah. So, there's a lot more summons going out, it looks like to me. I don't know how much of that would be rule, but like the southwest part of Champaign. Is that what that
is? The over representation, the green. Yeah, that's mostly, I think, because of the population change there. Mm-hmm. It comes out as an apparent over-representation compared to the 2006 data.
Okay.
I think it's an artifact. In the downtown area, in the central city areas, and this is a track level, so it's still it's at a pretty gross level here.
Okay.
The earlier ones were a little more detailed, but especially in the any parts of town, every place where you know there hasn't been a house built in 10 years, mm-hmm. it's probably pretty stable. There's new apartments and stuff, but it's a lot more reliable. On the edge of the town, I wouldn't put much weight on some of those on the over-representation.
Okay, it's also one of the things that it's obvious you put a lot of work into this. I'm very impressed, so thank you.
And this is the county level. So you look at the whole county, including Rantoul in the little box, and that's at the track level again, so that's still kind of a gross overview. And then that weird underrepresentation up at Foosland is because of a census error that they never corrected. I don't know if you remember that when they were redistricting. There was an extra 1,000 people moved from Urbana to Foosland by the Census Bureau.
Which?
Yeah.
So ignore that. That's another artifact. And this is the same view with at the flat group level, so a finer level of detail. And you can see a little bit more going on in Rand School there. And that's the African American population at that level. So that kind of gives you an idea of what kind of things we can do with the map. And if we had the right data, we could do something like you were talking about and do kind of a comparison from step to step. So this is, I made a few maps with Paula, what she was talking about. So this is the zip code level. And then in the blue outline is the ones that she had marked as statistically significant. Can you see that up there? It's so hard to see. And this is one with the little outlines. There's two, I also listed the zip codes there that were significant, 61820 and 22 in that version. I really couldn't, and again, Friesland pops out. Just ignore the Friesland square right there, the red spot. That's that Census Bureau problem. I didn't see a lot of, I didn't really see a whole lot going on at the zip code level. It's just kind of a big level to see much at. That's the same view except with the dots overlaid from what we actually know. So that's the dots aren't her data, that's our data, that's the summons data again. And the some of the other, like orange and red there, is just real low numbers, not very many people live there. You can see that with the dots, it's like two in that bottom one that turned red, but it's not statistically significant, it's just a kind of random area. Same thing with that red one. So at the zip code level, like she was saying, there's not a lot of significance. So these are different things. It's like undeliverable compared to qualified, no response compared to qualified. That's the one that was kind of significant. She was talking about the Rand tool and the Champagne, the two Champagne zip codes and Rand tool. Actually, Urbana's shown up there too. That's qualified versus response. So then, as far as the latest data I got from Roger was the non-response, which is just half the picture. So I got the numbers, the addresses for people that didn't respond, but I don't have the addresses of people that got the questionnaire. So I can't make a comparison there. But there were a lot of duplicates and residence halls. In the addresses I got from Roger, they didn't have room numbers in them. So I don't know if that's the way they're mailed. I know on the website, I pulled up their webpage, just how you're supposed to address rooms in residence halls. You're supposed to say URH room number and then residence hall name. And that URH room number isn't shown up anywhere in the addresses. So that's something we should ask Roger to check. Because I don't know what would happen if you just send it to Bill Brown at Florida Avenue Residence Hall. How many people would get it, or if they were to send it back, or you know, what would they do with it? So I wanted to also ask him if there's a written protocol to consistently generate these lists, because it would be important to make sure it's done the same way each time. I don't know if it's all automated, or if somebody is giving a list and saying, you need to take duplicates out of this, and everybody might have their own way of getting the duplicates out of there, and then it's not consistent. So that's something I think we should check, follow up on too. And I don't want to take too much, I don't want to take any more time, but if you want to look at the data, I mean, I think it was sent out to everybody, was it the no responses? If you use Excel at all, just sort it by address, and you can see, like, there's 20 duplicates to one apartment house, and like five of them are sent the same week. So there's something weird going on with sending out duplicates. And these are all non-response data. I don't know if they really got a questionnaire every day for a week. I don't know. Maybe it was the way the data was sent.
Judge, you might know the answer to this question. Maybe only Roger knows. But Bill, if you got from one address on one day or one week 20 duplicates, could that be 20 different people at one address, or one person gets 20, one individual receives 20 pieces of the mail?
Well, if it's one address and it's apartment number, I mean, how many, I don't know how many people can live in the apartment, but if it's every day for a week, there's something really going on.
There's a problem with the way that the
workers work. But we've looked with anybody who's done, try to put together a list of registered voters, you know, because they have been purged in one apartment, especially if it turns over more than once a year. Five young people sharing one apartment and it's transitioning. So yeah. There could be that way.
I can see there can be duplicates, but when you're selecting 5,000 people out of 144,000 names, you wouldn't expect one apartment to get too many duplicates.
Is this information that primarily should go to the court administrator?
Right. Well, Roger's aware of it. I think we discussed it with Roger about that. And he's going to look into that. Can I ask you a question? What do you think of this Hannaford's
I think the analysis is really good. The only thing I would question is the small sample the 1 month, looking at the race for 1 month. And I'm not sure I'd agree completely with their argument that that's better than court watchers determining race. Because you get a 95% sample from her, you get a 100% sample from the court watchers, although there is a difference in perception.
No, you don't get a 100% sample from the court watchers because they only look at the jurors that are brought into the courtroom.
Oh.
They don't go down and Monday morning and look at the 85 people that show up. They only look at the 35 that come into the courtroom. So the numbers are skewed. And again,
you know, but then what hers doesn't show too is how many people were selected from the jury. The only way we get that is through court watchers.
Well, right, yeah, right.
That
she,
last step.
She tells us how many actually came into the courthouse. The court watchers can look and see how many actually got to the jury box.
I think statistically and methodologically, I think it's fine what she's doing. I think it's real helpful. And I really appreciate her comments about her experience with other counties.
Obviously, I think,
speak
verbally, you seem to understand this
moment. Oh boy, I say that's certainly true.
Thank you.
I understand the oversampling she was talking about, but I also understand that there could be a problem with implement. But I think it's worth thinking about.
Well, that was Mr. Thompson's initial suggestion, was that we choose some areas and just send out our questionnaires that.
That's what oversampling is?
Yeah, it's basically sending out more questionnaires to areas you want to get people from.
Let me say that there was a couple times that Ms. Hannaford lost through in some of her comments, but I appreciated her to answer the questions, but I think there was a couple times that I felt those. And if we can't rely on the court reporter's data, then I'm not sure. I thought that based on the court reporter's data and their reports that we get getting year after year, and they've been getting a lot of attention, is why we are here. Because we rely on what they observed over the years. So I do want to give some credibility to the court watchers' report. I think that being there and looking, even though you cannot 100% say that just because this person is of color is their African American or what their ethnicity is, I still believe that there is some credibility to be given to the people that are in there to actually see who's in the box.
I'm sorry, I don't want to.
Sir, you're right. Mr. Weibel. My question is telling you reliability. So you can use each set of data, just have to realize that there's maybe a shortfall in one way or another. So certainly it's worth looking at, and that does tell us something. Just be aware of that. Okay, how is it collected? What are the shortfalls in that?
Right. Too bad. I should probably answer.
that my responsibility. I think it's a good springboard to use, you know, but it's just one piece of the pie. So. Mr. Dolan, do you have a comment?
Oh, I just, I'm no off that.
Okay, Jeff?
I have to go. The radio spots, I think we can, between the Bar Association and the Marriage Fund, we can do $900. Would that buy us 3 months?
I thought it was something like that. I can look back at my estimates that I got. It's in the minutes here.
Yeah, at the flat rate, you can advertise for 6 months for $1,800. For 3 months for nine, it would be $300 a month for 3 months. That would be $900. And I think it would be a mistake to not think of the ads that we can run at no charge from groups who are our partners who would have a public service.
But I did reach out to, I think it's, what is it, 107.9 or 107.5, Dwayne Hubbard, who's running that. I had asked him to come tonight, said he couldn't make it tonight. But just trying to partner with some of the radio stations to see if they would run some things as web. It's just me, but I'm looking for audiences where certainly young people and African-American people are going to be listening to. So I thought of 105.5, is it 107.9, those type of places, 96.1. But where it gets more air, you know what I mean? That's what I thought. Because a lot of stuff on web, we can do those PSAs and ask the airships to do some of that stuff. But we're trying to get them to partner with them. And if there's, if we could get 900 from that, what sort of fundraising or what could we do to actually get it done for a year? You know, to bring something into that instead of doing it. Because you get a much better deal if you do it for a longer time. So I was thinking about that. But I certainly will make note of that.
Yeah, I had it clear with the Chief Judge about using the marriage fund. Talk to the Bar Association, he has to make a formal presentation to them at their next meeting. I think it's the same. But we can do that. We're convinced we can do that.
Can we use some direct appropriation for 1590? Should ask Bobby to ask.
The state's attorney.
And apparently.
Well, you're right.
A lot of people are going to jail for drugs. So why can't we use that to increase
the state's attorney? So, we did not, are we losing quorum here?
I'm sorry, I have to be serious.
Well, I think that Judge DeFond is indeed aware of our appreciation for this, for the work he's doing with the questionnaire. So, I think
we have to take a look at all of this we presented and Mr. Dallin said, look at it, make changes, we'll do it at our next meeting. I'll be glad to consider whatever changes you suggest. And if somebody wants to draft a letter to the recalcitrant person that doesn't return the questionnaire, I'll draft one, but feel free to, because this has to be a different letter than what I initially gave. Okay. And then I think her point is good, that, and again, you said the same thing. They need to understand we are serious.
Right.
We need your cooperation.
Yes, ma'am.
Jeff, I thank you very, very much for the revisions. And I mean, it's hard to write something that you've got to say 12 people here, but thank you very, very much.
Well, again, we ran out of time, but again, the next meeting.
Thank you.
Well, in relationship to the meetings, I thought actually last month was very productive when we met twice. I don't know how people feel about that, but, you know, sort of like every 14 days until we get, you know, some concrete things on the ground and running, I thought it was most productive as opposed to waiting. So I wanted to see what you all thought about that quickly. What do you think about your meeting twice? Okay. All right. So I'll...
I'm up for that. I know that I think it would be okay with Joan if I mention the phone that we have. Since the night meetings are not going to work as we get later into the year,
okay.
Not everybody can drive at night.
Okay.
I can't drive at all. So I don't know. It seemed like it was difficult enough for us to arrive at 5:30 on Friday for a meeting time. But we might yet need to consider changing our meeting time for somebody volunteering to do transportation for those who have transportation problems.
Okay.
I mean, I have no problem. So obviously, we have a lot to try to digest in this meeting when we get through it. Twice a month, if that's a bad idea, like you said, we get.
So I'll propose those over emails for the next days so that we can make sure that we get those out. And I'll do it pretty quickly. Matt, I know I need to talk to you because I didn't get something done I was supposed to get done last time. So, and then the working group, I'll make sure all the stuff gets on the agenda and we'll make sure we get it done. I don't think it's going to be hard to get a working group. You said for the PSAs.
I appreciate the fact that Jeff should honestly thought about how we could come up with $900 for 3 months, but unless we have something to show, I mean, we don't have a product yet that we'll be paying for.
Right.
It's in Aaron's brain.
Yeah, well, I have talked to Mr. Yanchus. I talked to Stan Yanchus again, and I reached out to Mr. Hubbard because I was trying to put together something that would be creative and be catchy and things like that. So I'm definitely willing to come in and do the basic thing that we had from Judge Ladd and kind of just kind of get, because there's some things that have to be in the statement, that have to be in the presentation for the PSA. So I'm willing to come in and learn those things, whatever is good. You know?
Okay. And there was another thing about, we do have a brochure that we give the jurors, to make that available. And what I probably will do is just give you a disc of what she said.
Okay.
And then you can take the shoes off of that, which you think is appropriate.
Okay. That was cool.
Thanks, I got
it. Okay. And so I have the other things down here for you, Jim.
So follow up from the other person.
From the other, I think that was Matt had that, and then he also the, was something else that you had. Working group, old business, follow up on the interpretation of the statute.
Right.
And we really needed Roger to do some of that stuff. Okay, so public participation? No public participation. Okay. So with that, I'll leave this meeting, Mr. Chair. I'm getting comfortable in a seat up here, Mr. White.
Very good.